microphone goes off, and they need batteries. And 500, hundreds of people are sitting there. I'm sitting there. They're running out Sunday morning to get batteries. Danny, both looking. Regards from Eliyahu, your uncle, great uncle. It's I got to get it right, but sometimes I skip a generation. Okay, anyway, Bill, I want to welcome everyone sitting in front of us. It's great to be back in Modal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was a trip that covered a lot of ground and a lot of teaching and a lot of students. And if I would take it seriously, Rabbi Bednash was warning me yesterday, don't let it go to your head. I'm in the Baseball Hall of Fame today, but we'll talk about that another time when I want to deal with a little chinuch concept. But nothing is more joyful than to be back in the classroom. Today is second day of Hanukkah. It's the 10th of December, 2012. I want to dedicate this year. A student of mine died while I was in Chicago, someone that I've been very close to for many years, and it breaks my heart. I want to dedicate this year to the memory of Avi Shafrin, whose original name was Abe Greenberg, and even with the name change, it is indicative of our generation and what people have gone through. How did Abe Greenberg become Avi Shafrin? Abe Tavi, you can understand, but what about Greenberg, because his parents survived the Holocaust with miracles, and they were in a DP camp, and someone died who had a visa to America under the name of Greenberg. So they took Greenberg and came to America. Many decades later, his wife, later his ex-wife, whose name was also Shafrin, they were second cousins, insisted that he change back his name to the original family name, which happened to be her name. At least that's the story that was told to me. And Avi was a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, a Avat HaTorah, but had a very sad life on a personal level. And I just recall his memory fondly. He listened to the Shehurim. He was a friend. He was a colleague. He was a confidant. And he understood me to the end. I also want to make a correction in the shiur I gave at YU that attracted so much attention. Or Baron Cutler, you get carried away and your tongue moves faster than your mind. So when it came to, I was talking about my students are so insightful, and when they nickname someone, they know what they're doing, and I wanted to use the nomenclature that you use for Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, my classmate, Dr. Grach. And there I am praising my students, and I go on to say they call him HaGrach. To call him HaGon Reb Chaim, I don't need students to tell me that I can do. And I apologize, but anyone listening who heard the Shi'an Reb Aaron Cutler, make the correction, Dr. Grach, because that's really insightful and catches Chaim. Okay, now I want to move ahead, and it's a very fascinating Shi'an today. I'm going to move sideways and introduce you to something that you may want to think about for decades to come. New York dreamt, Josh, that if they get a chief rabbi, they're going to be on top of the world, solve all their problems. Children will be from, children will have an example, and HaKolam HaKomo Yavo B'Shalom. Do me a favor, make the output slightly less. I'm getting feedback. It's over there. I don't know. There's something that's Kedere Deve Shutve, as the Gemara says in Baba Batra. It's not hot, it's not cold. And I'm using a Kedere Deve Shutve. It's the side one, the first one. See if that can be made a little lower. Okay. Now I'm not getting feedback. Make it a drop higher. One drop. Okay. Leave it. Fine. Good. So they thought that all problems would be solved. And all eyes turned to the Malbim. Now I mentioned in class last time, doctor. I said he had a doctorate. One of my students listening from afar questioned me, where did he get the doctorate? The truth is, I've often wondered, did he really have a doctorate or didn't he have a doctorate? What am I trying to say? It could be people called him Harav Dr. Malbim because he had a tremendous amount of general education, but it may be he never formally had a doctorate. In RJJ's masterpiece on Rabbi Abraham Karp's masterpiece on RJJ, on page 132, you'll see that twice he's referred to as doctor, in quotes where he's quoting from the press. Rabbi Karp never really goes into the question where he got his doctorate. When I was a kid, I heard he got the doctorate when he was in Bucharest. That in Bucharest, Romania, which was a city that was open, that's where he got the doctorate. It may be, or it may be it's what you call an honorary doctorate, what we used to call in Lakewood kitchen smicha. Mrs. Berman, the cook who ran the kitchen, called every student in Lakewood yeshiva rabbi. And we called it kitchen smicha. So I welcomed the question and I researched it again. I don't have a definitive answer. But Karp does cite twice sources where he's called Dr. Malbim, and Karp does not have a footnote to the contrary. That's all I can say. If anyone can do more research and come up with a definitive answer, I welcome it. Now, it was the Malbim Moshe Leib Ben the Malbim Wednesday. Ben Yechiel Micho. What? Yeah. It's the Malbim. But it was Rashi Tevet. The name Malbim caught on, and he's known as Harav Malbim. It's like the Ridbaz. Ridbaz's name was really Volovsky, but Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev caught on. He was known as the Ridbaz. The Malbim caught on so much that there was a judge in New York City, there still may be, by the last name of Malbim. It was a direct descendant of the Malbim. So the Malbim would have been a wonderful choice, but Meneshamayim Lo Zachinu, he died, he was over 70, or he was exactly 70, and he died in Europe. And then began the tremendous search, who do we make the chief rabbi? And the European Rabbanim wanted Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz, the son of Reb Yitzchok Chanan. We dealt with that at length, why his name is Rabinovitz, not Spector like his father. And it's a fascinating story. I yet knew people who knew Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz. I remember having a conversation with Reb David Lipschitz, the Tzuvalka Rav, about him. And the Tzuvalka told me he was bigger than his father. Mamish bigger than his father. Thank you. He was bigger than his father, but because he wanted to escape the aggravations of the rabbinate, he went into business. Every rabbi dreams that the business world, when I was growing up, some of the most famous rabbanim became medical doctors. One of the well-known rabbanim in Philadelphia became an undertaker. I need not tell you, and as a matter of fact, I write about that in Washington. I need not tell you what statement that rabbi was making by becoming an undertaker. And he should live and be well. He's not a young man today, but he always had an aphorism, "I'm the last to let you down," quote, end quote. And if you go to Eretz Chaim, yeah, I don't have to say further, but this gentleman already put up a stone about 20 years ago in Eretz Chaim, and I think it's a school of Arichat Yomim. You have to put up a stone with your name on it and just let it stand there, and it's a school of Arichat Yomim. So Rabbanim were running away. Today it's the opposite. Medical doctors are becoming rabbis. In the New York area, I know of 3 medical doctors who are rabbis today. And all right, Baruch Hashem, everyone thinks the pasture is greener on the other side. But Reb Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz might have been very good for America, but the Americans were stubborn. No one's going to boss them around. And here I have to tell you that our friend from Satmar, Rabbi Yonah Landau, who I have a direct link to already, it's just amazing what you turn up with, but one of my students, Dr. Alan Blau, a direct link, knows him personally, very friendly with his son. They all work for Satmar, and my strictures on his scholarship have already been told to him. Shalom, you follow? but he gives you the Satma shrug, if you know what that means, that don't confuse me with the facts. If I want my opinion, I'll give it to you. If I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. So I want to tell you, here he has the story right. And I'm quoting from the Rav HaKollel by Yonah Landau, and beginning on page 212, he gives you the story of what went wrong with the Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz, and why, even before RJJ's arrival, there was so much opposition to RJJ. And he tells you the story of that the American mind was not going to accept a rabbi like Rav Tzvi Hirsch Rabinovitz, who went bankrupt. If he went bankrupt in business and had to change his name to escape his debtors, then Allah at Kama Vakama, he's going to go bankrupt and not be a good rabbi. And they didn't consider him. The other factor was that his wife went out of her mind. And this brings us, in America, I got hit with this on all levels, the feminism today, very, very, very strong. And you all know, if a man goes insane, his wife remains an aguna, he can't give a get. But if a woman goes insane, the man can have a het meir rabbanim and marry again. Al pi din Torah, a man can have more than one wife. And this is axiomatic. And the feminist hit you over the head on this point time and time again. My wife has a different attitude. She says that with the tragedy today of so many unmarried girls, we have to go back to polygamy. And I've often said in class that we dismiss polygamy very quickly. But if you were raised in a polygamous society, it's part of society. You're very happy. It's a fabulous system. One husband has four wives. If a wife is ill, another wife takes over. If one wife gives birth, another wife chips in. It's in your old age, who knows who survives. Not bad. This way, there's always someone around to take charge. But the problem is that we already, for thousands of years, have been raised one wife, one man. So I understand, I don't want to go further, but it's an interesting topic to think about, because we always think we're better than those that had two wives and three wives. We are better. Okay. His wife goes out of her mind, and Reb Siyash Rabinovitz gets a het the mayor Rabbanim to marry a second wife. No. Can we accept that? I want to ask you a question. How do you feel about that? How do you feel, Reb Malkiel Kotler, what went on here when his wife, who was married to the Brisker Rev's granddaughter, Feinstein, the Reb Moshe Feinstein's, it's a great niece, Masha Hukazah, and she refused to leave Israel when Reb Shneur Kotler died. They wanted to bring Reb Malkiel back to America to head up Lakewood, and she refused to leave, and he left, and he remarried. I don't know. She ultimately may or may not have taken a get. I don't know. But it became a topic of discussion here. It actually became a play. It became a very popular play in Israel on this very topic of the husband leaving her and getting a het meir rabbanim and remarrying. And how do you feel about that? The books were published, very strong volumes against Rav Malkiel Kotler, by the Soloveitchik family in Yerushalayim/Brisk. So Americans, you see, by the 1880s, the East European Jews who made it big in America not only had money, they Americanized. And to their minds, you do not take a rabbi who went bankrupt, a rabbi whose wife went out of her mind. They were too American to tolerate this. B'dieved, RJJ became the choice. Now, with RJJ, and here there's a very fascinating chapter in Harav HaKollel, and Yonah Lander has it exactly right. And here he hits the nail on the head. Meaning, RJJ was going to get a tremendous salary. The average rabbi in New York was getting $400 a year. They offered the chief rabbi $2,500 $500 a year. In addition, they offered him an apartment with furnishings. In addition, they were paying for him, his wife, his children, to make the voyage from Vilna to the United States. Beyond that, he told them he couldn't leave Europe. Now, in order to leave Europe and come in Aliyah, it's not like America. America, you can go to the airport, you can leave, unless you're a criminal, and there's a warrant out for you, which will show up on a computer. The same thing in Israel. You have what's called here a tzav ikuv yetzia. Many times a man is involved in a nasty get issue, or a woman for that matter, and they want to leave the country. And if you have a good rabbinic lawyer, he or she will get a tzav ikuv yetzia, and as you're about to leave the country, when they put your passport into the machine, it shows that you are a criminal. They press a button, and within minutes, the police surround you. And I have a Talmud who escaped, or a semi-Talmud, a gangster, one of the worst people I've ever met in my life, a sex fiend, God have mercy. And he got out of the country because the Tzav Ikuv Yetziah was taken out in Haifa. This is before email, direct communication. It's in the 80s or early 90s. And someone told him he ran out of the country that night. The next day, the Tzav Ikuv Yetziah arrives in Tel Aviv and they want to inform the passport control, and he already was on his way to the States. But basically speaking, in order to leave a country that's a democracy, no one checks whether you owe money, no one checks whether you have debts. In Europe and in the communist system, but even before the communist system, if you wish to leave, you had to go to the police. The police did research on you. You had to get a document that you have no debts, that you're free to leave. Reb Yaakov Yosef, the Magid Meisharim of Vilna, owed something like 10,000 rubles, or $10,000, equivalent of rubles. Reb Yonah Landau's Malamed Svitalov, remember what I told you, that he gave the money away to charity. And that's the story I mentioned last time with Reb Lazer Silva, an absolute true story. I just spoke with Reb Lazer's daughter, granddaughter this morning, and Reb Lazer Silva, the Balabatim, had to give the check to his wife because he could walk out of the shul carrying his monthly salary of, for the sake of argument, $500. He met a poor man who gave him a sob story, has to marry off a daughter and has no money. He would give the poor man $500 on the spot. So Reb Yaakov Yosef owed a lot of money. He could not leave till that money was paid off. So they had to make appeals, and all this soured the people. That Reb Yaakov Yosef, what kind of chief rabbi? Money, 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 money. All of you know that the rabbi and money should not mix. It leaves a bad impression in the public eye. This is why Rabbanim, the Rav, always used to be adamant, and you have it on tape with the Rav speaking in the 1950s, why you're rabbinic alumni, and the Rav is giving Musa to the Rabbanim, that if you make appeals in shul, you have to be the first ones to answer the appeal with a significant sum. A Rav Dafked Ben Staka, period. And you have to set an example, and you have to be gracious. But if all the Rav is asking for, a salary $2,500, an apartment with the most modern, latest furnishings, a car fare for the Rav, his wife, his children, Vilna, to Hamburg to the United States, and in addition, another $10,000 to pay off debts, there already was a lot of heartache even before RJJ arrived. Okay, finally, they raised the money, he pays off the debts, and he arrives, and that's where we left off, at Hoboken. What a magnificent Saturday night that was, in July of 1888. The chief rabbi is here, and Rav Yaakov Yosef has set foot in America, and he was already well known, Reb Yaakov Harif, a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanta, a Talmud of Volozhin, the Magid Meshurim of Vilna. You should know that this position, the Magid Meshurim, if you want to know how important that position was, Reb Menachem Karakovsky held that position in the 1900s. Who was Reb Menachem Karakovsky? The Avodat HaMelech, Moriu Rebbe's uncle. He was Rav Soloveitchik's uncle. The Rav stood in awe of Reb Menachem Karakovsky. He was, his Avodat HaMelech on the Rambam, of which 90% of the manuscript was never published because there was not enough money. Only the first part is published on Sefer Mada, I believe Sefer Ahava. Nothing else. Everything else was lost in the Holocaust. There was a manuscript on the entire Rambam. He, when the Rav was in Berlin, Reb Menachem Karakovsky, who had a sensitivity for Chachmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish scholarship, asked the Rav to look at manuscripts. And my last discussion with the Rav, face to face, 1983, one of the last topics I discussed with him in his apartment was his searching for manuscripts for his uncle in Berlin. See, it's fascinating because in Berlin, the Rav had some exposure to scientific Jewish scholarship. Later in life, you never heard one word from the Rav, not in the classroom and not outside the classroom. If anything, in his talk to the YURA, which a guy named Rakefet reproduces in the second volume of his work, The Rav, the World of, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the Rav describes the differences between him and German Orthodoxy. You follow me, Shalom? And if you take it a drop further, there is, German Orthodoxy. It's beyond him. It's not part of his ballpark. And German Orthodoxy had a great deal of Chachmat Yisrael in it. So much so that you couldn't get ordination in, I'm saying Shalom, Moshe. I keep on making that mistake because I had a stupid, okay, you know why already. Moshe. And you should have corrected me the first time. And the Rav had... There was a great difference between him and German Orthodox. German, you couldn't get ordination unless you had a doctorate. Hildesheim, it didn't give you the title rabbi unless you had a doctorate. Gentlemen, I want you to know, and I tell you this in parentheses, and I'm 99% certain I am correct. I am guessing. This is a nichush. But you take it further with people who knew the Rav well. There's a talk that the Rav gave on the efficacy of prayer. He gave that talk, if I'm not mistaken, Saturday night in Maimonides in Boston. And in that talk, the Rav spoke about the fact that sometimes when God doesn't answer your prayers, it's the greatest gift he will ever give you. And the Rav broke down and started talking and practically in tears that at a certain point of his life there was a position he wanted desperately. And he prayed so hard to the Ribbono Shel Olam that he should get that position. And God did not give it to him, and thank God he didn't get it, because the Rav said, had I gotten that position, I, my wife, my children would not be here today. We would be victims of the Holocaust. Rakefet's educated guess, putting the years together, the time. You know what position he was praying for? Magid Meshurim of Vilna. Exactly the position that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef held. Exactly the position that his uncle held. Why? His uncle died. I believe I have the exact date in the footnote in the Rav, but it was, if my memory is correct, 1929. Within a year or two, the Rav is married, the Rav has a wife, the Rav is getting his doctorate, the Rav needs a position, the Rav needs a future. His wife is from Vilna. His greatest dream, to be the Magid Meshurim of Vilna, to be on the Beit Din of Rab Chaim Oza Grishinsky. He prayed with all his heart I believe that's exactly what the Rav was talking about. And that was the position, Makid Meisharim. Had he achieved it, I wouldn't be sitting here today. But what can I tell you? Thank God that the Ribbono Shel Olam did not answer his prayers. But that was where RJJ was coming from. So you should have a feeling that the Rav desperately wanted this position. This was a position of cover, of prestige. A new light is dawning, shining in America. Okay, now watch. Acharei Mot Kedoshim. Today, Satmar adopted RJJ, Satmar Chassid, who's close to the Rebbe, I'm told. Which Rebbe, I don't know. It's Reb Aaron or Reb Zalman. It's probably Reb Zalman, because I believe he lives in Williamsburg. Satmar Chassid, the Satmar Chassidim, I was at Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's kever on his yard site. He's buried right between, if you take what's called the Jackie Robinson Highway, I think it's called today, Queens to Brooklyn, right there. He's buried right next to the highway. Right as you hit the border between Queens and Brooklyn, there's a big cemetery or two cemeteries. Right in one of those cemeteries is where Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is buried. And I was at the kever on his yard site, and my Talmud tells me, watch, in a few minutes, there are going to be hundreds of Satmar Chassidim here. And that's exactly what happened. Buses pulled up, people jumped out, saying to Tehillim, wow, Acharei Mot Kedoshim, today, what honor, what prestige. In his lifetime, everything that could go wrong went wrong. The next years of his life were absolutely horrendous. Even in death, the story is beyond human comprehension, how ominous and terrible it could be. Now, before we go into details, I want to show you an amazing source. I want to touch upon a problem. This is what I alluded to at the start. I want to touch a problem that all of us in this room, if we're Jews and have a Torah heart, all of us have to deal with this problem. In life, you don't want to be a greenhorn. Somehow, to be a newcomer, not to know the rules, the regulations, the language, the inside baseball, just as an example, you're left out. You're not part of the crowd. And no one wants to be a greenhorn. I remember the kids who came over from Europe right after the Holocaust, Lo Aleinu, came to Yeshiva Salanta, saying, "This kid can't read my word in English." Couldn't speak an English word. Their whole life they had spoken Yiddish. And suddenly they're in New York. And you should see these kids. Within a year or two, their English was better than most native New Yorkers. Some of my classmates conquered the world. But you don't want to be different. You talk about coming in Aliyah to Israel. Israel is very different because it's a conglomeration of immigrants. There isn't the same pressure here to become an Israeli. More than that, Anglos are looked upon, Labriyut, as coming from a higher society. I remember in the army, and I think I write this in Washington, the first time after I finished basic training and I was assigned to the military rabbinate and they assigned me to their lecture division and I had this appointment to their top lecture institution, the Midrashah HaToranit and the Mateh Klali. So the first time I lecture, I see some of the soldiers are laughing at my American accent. I never made that mistake again. The next lecture, I got up and said, "Baruch Hashem, I have an American accent, I was not born here, not raised here, and not educated here. I'm coming to you a pure American, and that's why I have a world to teach you. You can't believe how 200 soldiers leaned forward to catch every syllable from that American. And this goes on until today. I had an incident with my bank, a usual story, bank discount, one branch, another branch, my mother's branch, my branch. I don't have time to waste, so I was sending faxes to my late mother's, Zichrona Livracha, Reni Kaparet Mishkavam, in the 12th month now. I'm making a siyum next week. We have the yard site, and I'm making a siyum Masechet Brachot Baruch Hashem. I sent faxes. They get the fax, throw it into the wastebasket. I wrote a letter of protest to Central Bank Discount Bikoret. You don't know how they ran after me. And I opened up my mouth. I said, Ani aliti atza letiferet medinat Yisrael. Ze lo Kenya kan. Tzrichim livnot bank letiferes. Ma lo onim al fax? Ma ze? Ani lo ezrach min ashura lo magi li et hakavot habisisi shemanikim leben adam. Oh my gosh, they were shivering on the other side. And the head of the bank called, you know where? No, and then they wrote me a letter and I had to write back if I was satisfied. I thought, well, beautiful. The way you took care of it, lekavod teferet, that beat Mashiach, it came, Baruch Hashem. But you see, to be a greenhorn, you feel very, very awkward. And you're not going to have influence. If the world feels you're not part of that world, you're not going to have the same influence. And I'll give you a simple example, which I allude to in Washington. I'll give you a simple example. We had Rebbeim in YU play Tata HaShoah. Gaonim, Gedolim, each one a little different, each one, there's a little enmity between them, you know, Tells hated Mir. Mir looked down upon Slabatka. All three of them couldn't tolerate the Ungarische. Chassidim ein maladabeh, you don't even have to mention. But you see, you can have the greatest Rebbe in the world, but we all knew that Rebbe Lezer Volk, Rebbe Yerucham Gerelich, even Rebbe Hanuch Fishman, what a day in the Rebbe Noach Bornstein, Gaon Shebagainim. They didn't know English. They didn't know baseball. They weren't college graduates. You know, there was that little bridge, I would say, that we had to cross to meet them, and they had to cross to meet us. The Rav, on the other hand, you totally forgot about his accent. Why? Because the Rav could throw out something from baseball. I'm only warming up. The others would go crazy, you know. The Rav, Tova Lichtenstein, Dr. Tova Lichtenstein taught me a word. The Rav was a Brahmin. So I looked at her, I said, a Brahmin, what does he have to do with India? She said, look it up in the Webster's Unabridged. I looked it up. Brahmin means when you believe you're the best. New England, Harvard, Yale, what do they have for girls? What are their colleges called? Radcliffe. Oh my God. The hospitals. You're a Brahmin. The Rav was a Brahmin. You see, there was no boundary. And when he gave his shiur, I can tell you the day he changed to English, which was a tragic day. That was the end of Torah in America, my humble opinion. Yitzchak, if you don't have a sense of humor, Yitzchak, please, you don't have a sense of humor, let your wife suffer, let me teach. It was the end of Torah in America. Because at that, Yitzchak, am I right or wrong? We were a cliché. When the Rav switched to English, we became a cliché. But I'll tell you about the Rav switch. I don't go into detail, I don't have time. But I'm an eyewitness. I was sitting here when it happened. I saw the whole thing. I don't have to quote anyone else. My ears heard.
English conceptualization,
unbelievable. So the next day, the Rav tells Danny Greer, okay, you know, Danny Greer had come to the Rav. This is 1916. He says, Rebbe, you are holding back Jewish children from learning Torah. I didn't know that Danny Greer knew the Rav. His father was one of the Balabatim and Maria. We were flabbergasted. How do you talk to the Rav that way? And the Rav, you know, Danny Greer yelled at him, so the Rav took it, and the Rav said, what do you mean? What do you mean I'm holding it? Rebbe, I don't understand Yiddish, and I graduated Princeton. That's all the Rav out here, a Princeton graduate, the Rav. I came to take off a year to learn with you, Rebbe, but I will give the whole shiur tomorrow in English, and I will give you a bechinah at the end of the shiur. This was Tuesday. Wednesday, the whole shiur is in English. We were dying. Who could understand this English? Who could understand his terms, his conceptualization, what he did with Reb Chaim? I remember Abba Braunschweigel sitting there in tears, basically. And Danny Greer is sitting there. And at the end of the class, Danny marches up. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'm ready for the Bechina. And the Rav looks at him and he says, you understood? I'm too tired to give a Bechina. You understood? Good. We'll continue in English. And at that moment, Torah ended in America and Art Scroll came to the fore. And anyone who differs with me, you are entitled to your opinion. But I'm a cliché-ny, and you guys, what happened at YU last Sunday, they are a cliché-ly-she. Because I had a crowd of hundreds and hundreds of people, ranging from 30 years of age to 80 years of age, prominent rabbanim, big multi-millionaire balabatim, the shemin v'solet of the Torah unity, and I said, when I said avot in Yiddish, darf ich abteitschen in English? Yes, English. It is lost. I am a klisheni. You are a klishlishi. Ephraim is a klisheni. Baruch Hashem. Gentlemen, watch. So you think I'm just entertaining you with a story about the Rav that Nathaniel missed? No. Okay, watch. Moshe, watch. The name Abe Khan mean anything to you, Abraham Khan? Abraham Khan, a fascinating life story. 1860, just to put him into context, 1860 to 1951, Abe Khan was the typical story of Europe, raised in a frum home, raised among Hasidim, Tzaddikim, Anshei Maisa, became totally, completely irreligious, became a socialist, an anarchist, mourned whenever the Tsar executed his friends. He mourned in public. Ultimately, he had to leave Russia, or they would arrest him, and he was arrested. He could have been executed, and he finally got out, came to America, 22 years of age. Now, in America, he did come down a little, but he always remained a total socialist, irreligious, the founder, editor, main writer for the Forwards. When I was growing up, everyone knew the legendary Abe Khan, the big Forwards building in the center of the East Side. This was all Abe Khan. Now, what's fascinating about him is he wrote a 5-volume Yiddish memoir, Blätter from mein Leben, Leaves Out of My Life, 5 volumes. 2 of the volumes, I believe, were translated into English. I have it in front of me, yeah. Blätter von mein Leben by Abe Khan, volumes 1 and 2. 3 different people accredited as cooperating in the translation, and it was published by Jewish Publication Society. And he gives his take on RJJ. First of all, beginning on page 394, he starts talking about who the lay leaders were that put up the money and insisted on bringing RJJ to America. He mentions here Joshua Rothstein, president of Eitz Chaim, and he knew this Joshua Rothstein because we'll talk about, when we talk about Eitz Chaim, Abe Khan taught English in Eitz Chaim. And Rothstein was of some help to him. He was a broad-minded individual. He was a manufacturer. He succeeded. Tell me, does that name, Rothstein, mean anything to you? Gentlemen, Yitzchak, you're sitting on a chair. You're sitting on a chair in Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Chanan, right or wrong. Are you allowed to sit in that chair? Who gave money to help build the campus uptown. Who were the biggest supporters? The Rothstein family. For all I know, you're sitting on a chair that the money given for it was by Arnold Rothstein, my namesake, almost my name, Arnold Rothkopf, Arnold Rothstein. Charlie, do you know who Arnold Rothstein was? No? When you were a kid growing up, you ripped Kriya, you cried, you mourned. Shoeless Joe Jackson, Say It Ain't So Joe, the 1919 scandal, the Chicago Black Sox, do I have to tell you about Americana, and many books have been written, the man who arranged the throwing of the games, Arnold Rothstein. I believe it's a grandson of Joshua. Joshua, if anyone can check this out, I challenge anyone to check this out. I've had no success, but I believe it was Joshua, the father of Abraham, Abraham, the father of Arnold.
This generation we know from the movie with Barbara Streisand as Omar Sharif, the actor, the character he played in My Fair Lady. That's Arnold Rothstein.
I think it's Guys and Dolls, that the character is Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra plays, what's the name of the gambler? That gambler is based upon Arnold Rothstein. Now you're mixing up. It's Guys and Dolls. That's correct. That's correct. And I can tell you even more. Nathan Detroit. Zomen Sein Gesund. Nathan Detroit and Guys and Dolls, they say the prototype for Damon Runyon's Nathan Detroit was Moreno Rabbeinu Arnold Rothstein, who paid for the chairs that we have a what?
We have a difference of opinion. I'm telling you that, what was her name, Baby Smooks, the famous Jewish
Baby.
Fanny Bryce was with this Arnold Rothstein.
How does she relate to Arnold Rothstein?
They were paramours, as they say.
They were paramours. Guts a la pit. Okay, back here. It's better than the scandals we have today. That's all I can say. At least it was Arnold Rothstein. But I don't want to go into Williamsburg, London.
He was playing cards and losing and making.
Okay, I know that I have seen written that Nathan Detroit's, the prototype for Nathan Detroit, Damon Runyon's Nathan Detroit, played by Frank Sinatra's most memorable role, and Frank Sinatra's an obvious role. We can mention him. He helped smuggle arms in 47, 48. He got the mafia involved. Color Kavod to Frank Sinatra. He is Arnold Rothstein. Now, Arnold Rothstein, a book just came out on Jews and athletics, a popular book. In this book, there's a whole chapter on Arnold Rothstein. And this book makes the point that, yes, he helped fix the 1919 World Series, but he wasn't the only one. This book already gives a long list of people that were involved in fixing that infamous World Series. And I think in a few years' time, when it's 100 years since that series, we should call a conference in Jerusalem of Anglos analyzing what went wrong in 1919. Anyway, Josh Rothstein, I believe his son was Abraham Rothstein, and his son already moves uptown and becomes a big balabas in Kehillat Yeshurun. You follow me? In KJ. And the grandson, the Zun, is Mr. Arnold Rothstein. Now, day four, they bring the chief rabbi. Once the chief rabbi arrives, Abe Kahn gets a letter from his uncle in Vilna. He wrote me a letter which he said, quote, mind you, this is a document that you can depend upon because there's no personal reason here. This is not an art scroll statement in a history volume. Quote, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is very dear to us. He is a sagacious scholar and a rare God-fearing man. Our hearts are heavy with pain because we have to part with him. One does not want to lose such a precious treasure. See to it, Alta. Alta is Abe. His name was Alta Avraham. He was sick when he was a kid. See to it, Alta, that the Jews in New York know what a diamond they have taken from us. See that he is properly appreciated. I know that you don't attend a synagogue, but I do know, Alta, that you have a Jewish heart. So tell everyone that Vilna was proud of him and that New York should appreciate the precious crown it has now acquired. Now, here's a fabulous insight. Abe Kahn is moved by this letter, and he goes to hear a sermon by the chief rabbi. And he describes his feelings. He impressed me as being a scholar and an honest man of simple faith. But I could see that he was not a happy man, that neither the honor nor the fuss nor even the large salary were of primary importance as far as he was concerned. It was only his second or third sermon since his arrival, and already he was making a clumsy attempt to accommodate himself to the audience by using American Yiddish. Once he used the word clean for rain, and it was easy to see this was purposely done to show he was not a greenhorn. His efforts to acquire social polish failed. I'm going to go further in 1 second, but just think what he's saying here. Just realize the depth of these words. Here this man is getting up, he's preaching. The audience, 20% Americanized, 40% Americanized, 60% Americanized. Some of them are bringing their teenage kids who are 90% Americanized. And he wants to show he knows he's in America. So he throws in an English word. The chief rabbi knows the word clean. Rain. He doesn't have to use the Yiddish word rain. He uses the American word clean. But is he really Americanized? Watch what happens. I consider this paragraph the most important paragraph that Abe Kahn ever wrote. A whole world is revealed. At one point, he reached for a handkerchief in his pocket. It began to come out long and blue. He was suddenly embarrassed and struggled to put the handkerchief back into his rear pocket. It twisted around his hand. In desperation, he put the handkerchief on the lectern and soon had both his hands entangled in it. His American words sounded unnatural. It was a pity. Gentlemen, we have to blow our nose. What do we use? Tissues. When I was growing up, you used the handkerchief. How big was the handkerchief? A little square, a little rectangle. Christmas, Hanukkah. Every teacher, every Rebbe, what did you get as a gift? Students gave you a package of handkerchiefs. All right, we use tissues today. Did you ever see a European handkerchief? I remember when I did basic training in 76, there were some Russian Jews with me. Some of them had European handkerchiefs. I couldn't believe it. Just a big colored piece of cloth, about 2 foot long. They pulled it out. Used this part, put it back in, pulled it out an hour later, used another part. You looked at them. Primitive. It's exactly what happened to Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan. In front of a mob synagogue, he had to pull out a handkerchief and everything went wrong. These were Americans already using handkerchiefs that were a foot square, not a foot square. How big? Half a foot square. 8 inches square. And here he is with a European handkerchief and he can't get his hands out of it. And Everyone's sitting there. You forget what he's saying. You're laughing. You're pitying him. You are distancing yourself from him. I'm an American. I'm a Yankee. I'm a ball player. I know what's going on. I know politics. What does he know? And the chasm, the cleavage, the split is never going to be breached, never going to be repaired. It's very sad. That paragraph says it all. But he's not the only one who makes a remark. Show you something else. Memoir literature. When I was in Bernard Revel Graduate School, they used to send students to visit Yehuda David Eisenstein. Recognize the name? The Baal Otsrat. He lived to be about 104, maybe even 106. This man was a single-handed success story. We grew up the Otzi Yisrael. Otzi Yisrael, you know how many editors it took to put out the Encyclopedia Judaica. You know how many editors it took to put out the Jewish Encyclopedia. You know how many editors it took to put out the Encyclopedia Vrit. One man basically did it all, the 10 volumes of the Otzi Yisrael, and it's on a very high level. You have to remember, the Otzi Yisrael was committed to being in consonance with Torah. There is nothing in the 10 volumes that contradicts the Torah. And nevertheless, it is on a high scholarly level, in addition to being filled with Shas and Paiskim and Makarot. Among his many Otzrat, he left an autobiography and memoirs. I have the original 1929 edition. Otze Zrich Ronotai. Or the biography and memoirs, J. David Eisenstein. He goes year by year. Go to page 60, the year 1888. And in the first column, he describes a drusha by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. And here, too, you see the difficulty. Gentlemen, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik stated publicly that as a result of the Balabatim in Boston, he totally changed his darshanic method, if I may construct the word darshanic. And what does that mean? When he came to America, he used to give a drusha like the Europeyishu Rabbanim, like the European Rabbanim. No, look into HaMedrash Maisa. Look into Rabbi Yecheskel Lifshitz. What do you see there as a drusha? Of course, he takes a medrash, he analyzes the medrash, he takes a gemara, he's mafalpel, he adds, he subtracts, he brings in a story, brings in a mushel. It's a European way of darshaning. In the United States of America, the people had become accustomed to shorter sermons, sharper sermons, less pilpul, a message, la'inyan. And he describes the chief rabbi's drusha. He says, what he dashens is like the way they dashened in Vilna. Hadashanim halitayim b'li seder umurav. Lahag chabe, you know what lahag means? Idle talk, nonsensical talk. In other words, you're telling a story. It's not part of the medrash. It has no relevancy to America. You lose yourself in ma'at pilpul, the sirus hamikra art, and you quote the sentences and you mix them up. And he says, anyone and the osneha maskilim. But the intelligent, enlightened people are used to dashanim who speak a clear language, either English or Yiddish, and don't mix the two languages up. This is the drasha they're used to. And here the chief rabbi comes in, and it's totally European. It has no place or little reception in the United States. So you see, here you have a man, a giant, plucked out of Europe, brought to America, put down on the East Side, a world that he has yet to learn, yet to master, and he has to change the American scene. The odds were against him. What's that? What are they testing?
Fire alarm.
Fire alarm. Oh, that's what they've been working on. And, I see. Okay. No, color kavod. But, I was gone with the sirens, so I thought for a minute maybe they're catching up with us. But okay, Baruch Hashem, it's only a test on a fire alarm. Back here. You see, there was so much that he had to overcome. And you take this man who in Europe was totally at home, totally at ease, knew the ins and outs, and here he is on the East Side of New York. Not only that, you need more than the East European Jews to succeed. There were Jews uptown who remained Orthodox. There were Sephardic Jews who remained Orthodox. There already were synagogues that were integrated on the American scene that was strictly Orthodox. Take, for example, Shevet Yisrael, the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue of New York. Who was their spiritual leader? Rabbi Dr. Pereira Mendes. Okay? He was one of the founders of the seminary. He later moves on to join what becomes Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. The seminary after World War I and even before starts already to move towards a new religion, which later becomes known as conservative Judaism. Pereira Mendes was an Orthodox Jew. And at this moment, he was very upset with what was going on. Why? It was 1888. The seminary had just begun, had just opened its doors in 1887. And from the very start, East European Jews did not contribute. Who gave them the money? This was basically money from the German Jews. Why don't the East Europeans contribute? They're Orthodox. We want to turn out Orthodox rabbis. And if you have so much money to bring a chief rabbi who doesn't speak the language and only speaks Yiddish and doesn't know the mentality, and yet you have tens of thousands of dollars to guarantee him a salary, an apartment, to pay for passage, pay off his debts, why don't you help the seminary? And there was criticism on that side as well. The socialists in America, the anarchists, the revolutionaries, those that would later support communism and support Russia, and later generations who have incidents where people leave America and go back to Russia to be part of this fabulous communist experiment. These people spoke, I quote, "A dense cloud of superstition follows us from Russia in the shape of a rabbi's ignorance of any knowledge except that contained in the Talmud and the Midrash." The most bitter opponents were Jewish radicals, socialists, and anarchists. And wow, you can see what he stepped into. Okay. The rabbi has arrived. The rabbi rests. The first thing they do is draw up a contract. This contract is very fascinating. And I have to say, there are elements in the contract that every rabbi should be in favor of. What is one of the disgraceful aspects of the rabbinate? Do you give the rabbi a salary, or does he live on shnor arai? When a rabbi has to live on shnor arai, on begging, on handouts, he is subject to much disgrace. Now, what am I talking about? Handouts, begging. When the Rav came to Boston, he did not get a salary. He was brought there by a number of Orthodox shuls who came together and formed the Chevra Shas and formed a Vad Ha'ir. And what does it mean? The Rav comes to Boston, gets a salary from Kashrut, gets gifts from the Balabatim, Hanukkah time, Purim time, Mechirat Chametz, Siddur Kedushin, funerals. I need not tell you, all this opens a rabbi to graft, opens a rabbi to having to fawn and be obsequious. It's a sad existence. With the chief rabbi, they sense this. And part of the contract that they worked out was that he gets a salary and he's not allowed to accept any side income from kashrut, from divorces, from licensing of sheikhtim, excluded as sources of income on divorces, hechsherim, and the licenses of sheikhtim, for which it is herewith stipulated that he may not derive any income. As far as hechsher and sheikhtim, the chief rabbi is the absolute authority. The Balabatim can suggest people to be appointed as mashkichim, can suggest people to be appointed as sheikhtim, but if the chief rabbi does not give his approval, the Balabatim have to back off. He is the final authority. Anyone who officiates at a marriage for any members of the association must have authorization from the chief rabbi. And it goes on and on with the details of his salary, but what they set up was a vehicle that at least in theory he would be able to function in dignity. Finally, Shabbos Nachmu comes and he's going to make his first public appearance. Announcements are put up. The chief rabbi, the Gaon, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, will tomorrow, Shabbos Nachamu, at 4 p.m., deliver his first sermon. Beit Medrash HaGadol, 5256 Norfolk Street. The synagogue will open at 3 p.m., admission free to everyone. Now, you wonder about that admission free. That's something else that you don't know about. Chazanim. Jews love chazanim. I already saw this in my youth. No, you bring Yesel Rosenblatt to the Beis Medrash HaGadol in the Bronx. You have to pay him. Chazanim don't come cheap. How can you charge for tickets on Shabbos? You know what went on? And this went on all over America. You would buy the ticket in advance. If you bought the ticket, you got a colored bindle, a red rope. What word should you use? A cord, like a I don't even know. What can we have any similar? Like you get from Kevar Rachel would be analogous, and you wore that on Shabbos. You couldn't carry, but you would wear the bindle. What do they call what they give out from Kevar Rachel? What's the English word for it? What would you call it? But you need, there has to be an English word. A bracelet. A bracelet seems too dignified. But okay, a chut. They call it a chut. B'Yivrit says, a chut me'kever Rachel. But that's what they wore to show that they prayed to hear the chazan. Here they're telling you, you can come for nothing to hear the chief rabbi. It was an overflow crowd. The police had to keep order, had to lead the chief rabbi in. Here, he writes about this in a letter to Europe. I'll give you a source, but leave that for next time. That here he had come from Europe when the only time the Jews saw police when there was a pogrom, and perhaps the police were coming finally to put peace back into the community. Here, four policemen surrounded the chief rabbi and led him in dignity and cover to give his first drasha. Spoke for 45 minutes, spoke, and I can give you the heart of the talk was very simple and very well organized and very nice. He spoke in terms of a book has to have an introduction, and now the time has come to introduce what I want to do here in the United States. And he quoted text, he spoke in Yiddish. That first drasha hit home with all the little intricacies that perhaps we noticed before with a later drasha. But he spoke in terms of the Makarev people and Tinok Shenishpa, and that no one is an apikoros in America, and there were no rabbanim here, and there were no yeshiva, and there was no guidance, and therefore we have to start helping bring about a Yiddishkeit in the United States that can thrive. By this point, and it has to be said to the credit of some of the uptown Orthodox rabbis, including Pereira Mendes, when they met the chief rabbi, they were enthralled. And this is something that we all live with, perhaps. We can have our own opinions, our own viewpoints, but when we meet an Adam Gadol, even if his hashkafa or his background or the milieu in which he functions is light years away from us, we embrace him, hug him, kiss him, have derech eretz for him, because we know his heart is Torah. Pereira Mendes became one of the biggest supporters of the chief rabbi in the ensuing years. Okay, so now we have the chief rabbi in the United States. He had a tremendous problem that none of you will have in the rabbinate. What do you do first? We've had students in the Kollel go to endless different communities in the United States. There is never a problem. Why? Kosher food is readily available today. The greatest miracle that came about is when Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva, being mater empire kosher chickens. You don't know what a machloket took place. I give you one example, Philadelphia. Philadelphia in my time when I was Rav there in the early 60s did not allow frozen chickens in. Can anyone tell me what it's called halachically, what the Easter is, what the prohibition is? Shchutei chutz. Shchutei chutz. Sheikhtim have to make a living. You allow frozen chickens in. You are killing the panasser of local sheikhtim. Not only that, from time immemorial, you had local sheikhtim. Who heard of importing meat? Daniel, you are a sinner if you bring an empire kosher. Tremendous battles were fought. Reb Moshe Feinstein understood very well that every sheikh in America will be able to get a job. May not be in Philadelphia, it'll be in Hendada, Pennsylvania, where empire began. And he wrote a tshuva, and he said it's going to have tremendous benefit because Jews will be able to get kosher chickens all over. Gentlemen, we live in a world that you can travel throughout the civilized world, no matter where you are, you can get kosher products today. The OU, the Hashgacha, the symbols, the only place where you can't get is in England, because you have to, there they don't put symbols on the products, you have to have a book with you, you have to learn, almost everything is kosher in England, but an outsider will not know. The locals who live there and have the books, and it's a fabulous world today. 1888. So you come to a new community. You don't have to worry about kashrut. You don't have to worry about kashrut. You immediately go to work teaching, inspiring. The only ones that have to worry about kashrut today are the shluchim of Chabad. Because the shluchim of Chabad can wind up in communities so distant from society, so distant from civilization, that day, if you read the memoirs when they first came to Mumbai or elsewhere, what they went through, because you have to eat breakfast every day, you have to eat lunch every day, you have to eat supper every day. We're human beings, we're used to three meals a day, but the other two meals a day. Follow? But Ron J.J., unfortunately, had he been able to begin with chinuch, had he been able to begin with a Beit Din, had he been able to begin with teaching the public, with adult education, with all that you do when you come to Kalamazoo, Michigan, with all that a shaluch does if he comes someplace favaf and forsaken in the United States. But here, the first thing Rabbi Yaakov Yosef had to do was kashrut. Now, this became a great tragedy. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef brought over a Beit Din from Europe. Among the people he brought over was the father of Mordechai Kaplan, Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan. Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan was his right-hand man. There were sheikhtim in America. There were sheikhtim who now came to America. Sheikhtim slaughtered in front of the Beis Din, in front of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Sheikhtim got Kabbalah. Mori Rebbe gave Kabbalah, Rav Soloveitchik gave Kabbalah to my, the tradition in my family has it that my great uncle, who was a sheikh in Taunton, Massachusetts, New Bedford, Massachusetts, had Kabbalah afterwards from Rav Soloveitchik, from Mori Rebbe. Sheikh has to get Kabbalah. They started to organize. But then you come to this tremendous question. You have to supervise. Who pays for the supervision? And this becomes the challenge that no easy answer was found for. Today in the United States, all of us look for an OU. Hundreds of thousands of products under the OU, the Chafkei, the OK, a thousand and one other Hashgachas, but they're the big three. Who pays for it? You pay for it. But how do you pay for it? Because every product that is produced takes into consideration when they set the cost that for the sake of argument, Coca-Cola has to pay $500,000 a year for supervision of its various plants across America. So the price of Coca-Cola, they figure in, it's another penny per bottle to cover the supervision. Right or wrong? How is it? How do you pay for supervision today? You don't feel it, but it's like a Visa. A Visa card. How come everyone uses a Visa? Isn't it better for them to get cash? They use a Visa, they're losing 1%, 2%. There's one credit card that half the places don't take in America, American Express. I saw that with my own eyes. We were invited out to dinner. The people want to pay with a credit card. American Express, they won't take it because American Express takes a high, I don't know what the percentage is, let's say 3%, 4%. They'll take a Visa, they'll take a MasterCard. And I've seen that before. But the same thing with kashrut. The Visa, Master, it's figured into the price. Everyone in the world knows that we use credit cards today. As a matter of fact, many businesses will not take checks today. Right or wrong, right here in Israel, try to pay someone with a check, they'll lift you up and throw you out. Come back with cash or a credit card. Why won't they take a check? Because if it's a check bounces, they're going to have to whistle. Visa, Master, is guaranteed. Right or wrong, talking economics, terrific system. But you're paying for it. The price is figured in. In other words, if you're buying a book that should cost 52 shekel, it's being sold for 53 shekel. In Israel, where the food is taxed and they figure in the taxes and whatnot, and you pay with a Visa, a MasterCard, everyone pays, Osharad, Rami Levi, Mega, wherever you buy, no matter where you buy, Supersoul, Hippocold, no matter where you buy, you're paying with a credit card. Well, it's figured in that you have to pay an extra 0.15% because it has to cover the expense of the credit card. This became a tremendous debate. Who pays for kashrut? In a normal society, kashrut should be the expense of the community. Halavai, with day schools, we could achieve this. The community is obligated to have education. The community has to pay for education. Open up the Rambam Hilchot Talmud Torah. You'll see what I'm saying. Who gives the community the money? We pay taxes to the community. But it's psychologically very different if you're paying taxes to the community than if you're paying a special tax to pay for kashrut. And this became a tremendous debate. And the chief rabbi said, when it comes to kashrut, the kehila should pay for kashrut. We have to pay the shaytim. We have to pay the rabbanim hamachshirim. We have to make kosher food available. And the housewife buying the chicken, buying the meat, should not have to pay an extra cent. All this has to be covered by the community, by the contributions, by the organized kehila that brought the Rav HaKolel to America. Unfortunately, and this is the great, great tragedy in retrospect, the Balabatim looked at the rabbi, "You're a greenhorn. We know more than you." And they did not accept his feelings. And I'm going to give you a mashal. I'm going to end off. I'm going to give you a mashal right from the world. Today, Sam, what's happened in that office where I sit, right now, here, give you a simple mashal. I get a call, Talmud. It's a very big position. He was my student. His father was my student. He runs one of the tremendous rabbinic programs in Israel that reaches out all over the world, placing rabbis. They're contacted by a very illustrious congregation. And they know that I know the area. That is correct. It's an area in which it was said to me, I don't want to mention the name of the area, but it was said to me a year ago when I was there, a year and a half ago, "Harav Rakefet, you are a miracle man." I said, "I'm a miracle man? What have I done lately?" "You're the only rabbi that everyone loves. Everything else, there's my client." I said, "Sure. I'm a miracle man because I don't have to take a salary from you. I'm a guest giving some lectures. Baruch Hashem. If I had to take a salary and be in the community, I wouldn't be a miracle man anymore." "What's the fault line? One particular shul in this area, unbelievable, their history with rabbis." It's very simple. This shul has about 10 billionaires in it and about 50 multimillionaires. Now along comes a rabbi, 30 years of age, 40 years of age. Oh, they're going to give him a salary in six figures. Big deal. "Rabbi, what do you know? I made billions. I own half that block up there with every building 40 stories high, where the most famous movie actors and actresses live. You're going to tell me what to do?" Another guy, "Real estate. I've made deals. I've put together buildings. I have built in the billions, Rabbi. Please, don't tell me what to do." And by the way, I'm not overstating. It's exactly the case. Any rabbi there, he's in it. I always tell rabbis in such shuls, all you do is teach, set an example of Torah, the Yirat Shemayim, Paskin Shilas, do chesed, don't get involved in anything beyond. Because these are Balabatim, Rebbe Hayam Mechabed Ashirim. Those of you that heard my lectures on Das Torah know my explanation. Mechabed Ashirim? That Rakefet has to honor wealthy people? What are we talking about here? You got a lot to learn. If a guy made billions, you follow me? You got a lot to learn from him. He's okay. Moshe, he's a smart guy. Got to be quiet. The Baal HaBakim said to the chief rabbi, "Chief rabbi, we've made hundreds of thousands of dollars. Remember, that's like billions today. We're businessmen. We know America. We're going to put a tax on the chicken, not the meat." Interesting. Today, which is considered more luxurious, meat or chicken? Go into a restaurant, took me to, among other restaurants that I ate, in a very fancy restaurant in Chicago, the fanciest, I'm told. The prices were unreal. Lamb chops, $88. I thought I was looking at shekel, 88 shekel, $88. Wow. The meat, infinitely more than the chicken. Chicken, you could get away with $36, svei molchai. But the meat? What about in London? Tell me, Sam, what's considered more expensive? In New York, it's in Israel, it's meat much more than chicken. Always meat. Okay. What about in where? You're saying no?
No, I remember from my father's time, Shabbos you would have chicken. Every week you could have meat.
So at this time, isn't that something? Chicken was much more luxurious than meat. So the Baal HaBakim decided to put a 1 cent tax on the chicken. Anyone who bought a proper kosher chicken, slaughtered by the Shoichtim, under the supervision of Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, they put a plumber on the chicken. Do you know what a plumber is, gentlemen? A metal little, have you ever seen, tell me, do they still do it in Empire? In my time in America, in Empire, in every package, there was a plumber with a seal over it. Siman betoch siman. In Israel, you don't have that. It's interesting. I don't ever recall. You see it here, too? I don't... Here they have paper and a seal, I understand, but not a metal plumber that's stuck. In America, I remember we used to take the plumber off. But here, I have not seen a plumber. For that plumber, you paid an extra penny. That extra penny brought the chief rabbi down. If you have a heart filled with Torah and you don't want to cry, don't come to next week's class, because I'm going to read you a poem that became the most popular poem in the East Side community, and you will cry. And it's just unbelievable. When you look back now, the Baal HaBakim looked at the rabbi. "You're a greenhorn. We made it here. I'm a cap manufacturer." There were Baal HaBakim who lived on the east side. There was one fella, Chuck, a German, a Yekka, who deserves all the covet in the world. He remained from and loved the East European Jews. And he used to come down from the east side every night. They come down from the Upper East Side. He lived in 61st Street, I believe. Come down every night to help out on the Lower East Side where he began. And these Baal HaBakim, they knew more than the chief rabbi, so they thought. Meat, that's for poor people. But the chicken, if you can afford a chicken, 1 penny, well, now a penny was money. It's not like today. Today I'm amazed. You walk in New York, pennies are on the street, no one even bends down to pick them up. When we were kids, we used to have our big hakira. Oh, do I remember this hakira, that what happens if you see a dime on the floor on Shabbos? What do you do? Do you stand on the dime till after Shabbos? Are you allowed to stand on the dime? You follow me, Moshe? You have one dime. What's a dime today? New York, pennies, nickels, dimes. People don't even bend down to pick it up. But 1888, figure out that $400 a year was a salary like today of $200,000 or $150,000. A penny was a penny, okay? 1 extra penny for the plumber on the chicken. To reiterate, there's no question that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was a moment of great hope. But like Min HaShamayim Lachamu Kenegdo, Satan was out to get him. Everything went wrong. according to Yonah Landau, and I'll accept his word, that all the money he owed in Europe was because he was a tzaddik. And you know that there are people like that. You know the way Rav Elyashiv lived. I once went, we had a very, what to me was a difficult shaila out of Russia, where a guy was in labor camp and he got married, and they were so excited that they could do the marriage, and they forgot to have the ketubah signed, and now he's in labor camp and she's in Odessa, and the ketubah has not been signed. What do you do? And I remember I said to Rav Elyashiv, "Chabda Ashfera Shaila, Yesh Li Bayak Kasha," and he heard the Shaila, "Lo Kol Kach Kasha," it's not so difficult, you know. He gave a psak immediately. He was in it, but the way he lived in such simplicity. Rabbi Levine, I saw Rabbi Levine in 1968, right before he died. He lived right next to Machne Yehuda, not the way Nachla Ud is being rebuilt today by the wealthy Americans. It was a dump, and that's where Rabbi Levine lived. And there's such simple, the Chafetz Chaim, what can I tell you? There were great Jews, but here they bring the chief rabbi, they want them to have dignity, and everything goes wrong. The sermon, the lack of acculturation, this is natural. In Israel, we do not feel it, because Israel's an ingathering of the exiles. Anyone under 20 here who speaks Hebrew is arrested for desecration of airspace. In Katamon, in Rehavir, in Talbia, only the kids speak Hebrew. In my neighborhood, if you don't know French, every day I'm getting another note in my box in French, which I already figured out. We want to buy an apartment in your building, cash on the line. And then, believe me, you're the happiest person alive. The French, the British, the Americans, the Russians, the Ethiopians. What an ingathering of the exiles from South America, tribes. Ultimately, there'll be 500 million Jews here. There'll be all different shades and colors. But what? The 12 tribes will be back. Shviat will be the Oraita. Shmit will be the Oraita. Trumat Maisrat may be the Oraita already. I still haven't found anyone who can show me that I'm wrong, that it's not a Oraita right now. Look at the Rambam, Hilchat Trumat Maisrat, you'll see what I'm saying. So that problem, he might have been able to overcome. The problem is real. This is why what made BMT into BMT was that they picked up a faculty member in 69 named Rothkopf, who knew baseball, in addition to a little bit Shas and Paiskim. That's what made BMT BMT. You follow? The acculturation. You can overcome it. You can overcome it. You can overcome it gradually. But when you come to the kashrut, one penny more, and what this penny did. Gentlemen, I want to mention that we had Gilui Eliyahu. If you remember, everyone in America, wherever I went, I never saw so many Talmidim. What's going on? Can I inherit? I have become the greatest supporter, devotee, and advocate for the computer. What this computer does for Talmud Torah, Yitzhak, you're laughing? In Chicago, people hugged me, kissed me, made bracha. They're crazy. Cried. One guy took off 2 days from work just to ferry me around. Malka and myself, the people Talmud I never met that knew me inside out. So I want to tell you, everyone is talking about Rabbis Rice and Ilaway. I don't know, somehow that theme so caught on. Wherever I walked, Isaac Rice, who studied here, came over to me in YU, said to me right away, "Rebbe, everyone is asking me if I'm related to Rav Rice. Everyone is listening." So I want to tell you, I asked whether they still have Jewish children. We have a gentleman sitting here, Morty Tarragon, okay? He is the grandfather of how many direct descendants? 7, did you tell me?
10.
10 already?
10.
From one daughter and son. My brother's still ahead of you. He has one daughter with 13 children, so watch who you talk to.
Two oldest are down here in school.
Two oldest are in Machon Lev. Direct descendants of Rav Ilaway, sitting right here, his grandchildren. As far as Rabbi Rice, we uncovered Charlie contact who I told him to contact, who we both know, and we hit the right name. At the 150th yard site, an entire Haredi family was there from Muncie Rosenberg, direct descendants. And in the state of Israel, there is a Rice family, direct descendants. So we, Yesh Tikva Li Achritecha. This, please pass back to Yitzchak. That's 1 second, Rabbi Weiss. Now, watch this. Are you aware of what everyone is talking about in America? The New York Times picked it up. Who is this gentleman? He is the new president of Yale University. Am I correct, Yale? 1 second, let's just see. Yeah. Anaya Soloveitchik, Rosh Yeshiva in Yale. His name is Soloway. All the Soloways are Soloveitchiks who Americanized their name, or even in Europe already. I went to school with Soloways in Solanta. He is the new president, a direct descendant of Rav Chaim Voloshin. His father and the father of the, according to the New York Times, and he wrote this in response, his father and the father of the Beit HaLevi were brothers. So he does not come down through the Beit HaLevi, but he comes down through the Beit HaLevi's brother. It comes down through the Beit HaLevi's father's brother. If you're interested, I got a number of emails. It is unbelievable where we're at today. But my question is, wie frum is er? I don't want to translate that, but ultimately, that's what we have to know. Now, this is also very interesting. It's a point I made in my lectures on German Orthodoxy about 6-7 years ago already, and someone came up with a proof adding to what I said. And what I said was very simple, that when the Yekeshid Jews met up with the Pelische Chassidim, the Ungarische, the Litvische, they were overwhelmed by their piety, by their dedication, by their learning. And many Yekes threw away all their Yeke heritage and became totally Hasidic, Ungarish, or Litvish. And here's a story about Rabbi Dr. Shimon Yisrael Posen, with a doctorate, with a published book, and later he meets up with Hasidish Ungarisha and becomes the biggest zealot in the world.
You know that he married a Reuben?
He married a Reuben. And where are the children? Did they survive?
Yeah, they came with the, he was the Rosh Hashiva. I was at his house. I'm from Rangin.
Yeah, where?
He was the Rosh Hashiva for the Satmar Rebbe.
He was the Rosh Hashiva. And that's your Yichus. And that's what you're boasting about. Gentlemen, let it be recorded that Yitz Reuben has a cousin who was the Satmar Rosh Yeshiva. My dear friends, Sunday's class does not go for nothing. It's $36,000 to the IOU list. All charge plates are accepted. What am I doing beginning Sunday? Oy, halavai, they would have done this for me when I was your age. I'm beginning how to paskin a she'ela. It will come to the Shach, will come to the Choshen Mishpat, but I've put it all together. I will call it Kuntris Psak Halacha. It'll take us many months, but Sunday we begin, Minig we have finished. Next week we pick up exactly where we left off with the famous poem that says it all. Next week is a very sad Shayur. Bring handkerchiefs with you, European, American, or tissues, because a lot of tears will be shed. I want to once again express my thanks to the Ribbono Shel Olam for enabling me to speak in such wonderful communities to so many people. I hope a little bit hashpa, and above all, that chazati habaita, it should only be bebriyut, begashmiyut, beruchaniyut, and we should only have Besora Tova and a wonderful Chag Urim Oleinu V'Kol Yisrael. I'll say one vot in Hanukkah. It's not nice not to say one vot in Hanukkah. I'll say from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I heard this vot with my own ears. A whole group of us went to the Yutet Kislev for Drengen that year. No, Yutet Kislev, right, is right before Hanukkah. And evidently they told the Rebbe that there are a bunch of wise guys there from YU. So the Rebbe looked us right in the eye, at least I swear he was looking right at us, like any good chassid. I swear the Rebbe was looking right at us, okay? And the Rebbe says, I'm living it in Yiddish, but saying it in English. Damn it, we're a klishlishi. So the Rebbe looking right at us says, it's a good thing that the Maccabim were not Litvakin, or there'd be no Hanukkah. So we perk up, or, you know, we're looking at the Rebbe, what he says, Ich war ach Mazbezein, I'll explain. You know, thousands of people, but I can swear the Rebbe was talking right to us. And he was right. He said, very simple. If the Litvakin went in and they found only one little cruse of kosher oil, what would they say? You go with halachic principles. Ones rachmana patre. Ones rachmana patre. It's going to take you 8 days until you can get the kosher oil. In other words, it's going to take 7 more days. Why 7 days? The Rishonim explained. 3 days to get the Tzvat, Shabbos is in the middle, and 3 days to get back. 7 days. Einis Rachmana Patre, Ein Somkin Al Hanes. How do you light candles? Put it aside. We'll wait 7 days, and when we get the additional oil, because there's a din that once you light, you don't want the light to go out. It has to be tzmitut. It has to be constant. So you don't want the candles to go out. You don't want the menorah to go out. So therefore you wait 7 days and then you light the candles. And that's good litvishus thinking. Einis rechmana patre, ain't something al hanes. It makes a lot of halachic sense. Baruch Hashem, the Maccabim were Hasidim, and the Hasidim say, Mitzvah HaBoliyot Chaltach Mitzena, we do what we can, and the rest we're Somech Ala Kaddish Baruch Hu. It's a vod from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Danny, get a new watch, and 5 to 9.